Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Completed home foreclosures hit a nine-month high last month, 59,134. But behind that number, the American housing market is slowly recovering, and investors are jumping in. Not just your Uncle Bob snagging a new rental property or two, but big Wall Street players, giant private equity firms, scooping up thousands of foreclosed single-family homes and turning them into rentals. Something new at this scale. It's changing the market. It may change your neighborhood. This hour on Point, big money heads into single-family homes. We'll look at the changing real estate market. You can join the conversation. Have you seen it on your block? Would you welcome it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New York is John Gray, Global Head of Real Estate for the Blackstone Group. John Gray is a big deal. In 2007, he orchestrated a $39 billion leveraged buyout, the largest ever at the time, of Equity Office Properties, which managed 103 million square feet of office space. Blackstone, the big private equity operation in New York, is now pouring cash into buying single-family homes. It's purchased 10,000-plus homes across the country, and it's just one big player. John Gray is leading the charge for Blackstone. He joins us now from New York. John Gray, welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
10,000-plus homes. Where are you buying, or where have you been buying, John?
We've really been buying across the U.S., but primarily in the markets that were most affected by the downturn, so places like Southern California, Phoenix, in Florida and Miami, Orlando, Tampa, Atlanta, Chicago. So really the markets that were in the eye of the storm.
And how do you buy? Have you had agents out at lots of foreclosure auctions?
Well, if you back up for a sec, what we're trying to do here is build a company to provide to tenants the opportunity to live in quality homes on an affordable basis. And so what we're doing is building a company called Invitation Homes that's going to operate nationally, much like national apartment companies do. And so we've been going out with this company, which today employs more than 3,000 people directly and indirectly. We go out, buy these homes. Today, as you can imagine, these foreclosed homes are generally in poor condition. They're vacant. They need capital. We come in, fix them up, rent them up, and then lease them out to tenants. So it's a national operation and something that's really never existed before in scale.
Maybe because there's never been a moment quite like this. I mean, so much of the American housing stock came up in the years after World War II, and people bought it one single family home at a time, one family buying at a time. And here we had this huge wipeout. Do you see it as a, I don't know, maybe once in a lifetime opportunity to get into this part of the real estate market?
Well, it's certainly a moment that has not existed in the past. So yes, you have not had the opportunity to buy homes in scale or build a company like we're building. There are 12 million homes today that are rented out. So that exists, but mostly on a mom-and-pop basis. But because of the crisis, there's a need for capital to come in here. Our capital comes from primarily pension funds who are looking to generate favorable returns. And so today, because of this distress and dislocation, we can come in here, deploy a lot of capital, and build a very large company. I think it's quite beneficial both for the neighborhoods where we're deploying the capital, but for the economy overall and the housing recovery, because there's a huge overhang of homes that need to work their way through the system. So by having this capital come to bear, I think it's quite beneficial overall.
It's kind of mind-boggling, too. I think about just, you know, what it takes to keep my own gutters clean and trim, painted. You're going to do that for thousands and thousands of homes. What range of home are you buying into, John? Low, mid-range, high-end? Where's your target?
I would say it's mid-range. The average home we're buying today is about $155,000. And so I think it's pretty reflective of average homes across America. It reflects back to your once and maybe a lifetime moment here, home prices falling. I mean, that's probably on average down about 50% in these markets from where these homes were valued in 06. So there's been a very, very sharp decline in value. And that's one of the opportunities here. The other factor is that no one's building, or there's very little in the way of new construction in terms of housing.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, their population's growing faster than new home construction. And so we think that'll support recovery. In terms of operating, cleaning the gutters, we're building a very large company here, and we're spending a huge amount on infrastructure. We're partnered with the largest apartment company, third-party manager, called Riverstone, and we're building out a very large company. So the goal here is to deliver great service to tenants across the country and provide affordable housing for them in neighborhoods where they want to live. Obviously, given the economic situation, there are a lot of families who can't afford a down payment but want to live in a community and send their kids to a certain school.
It's a lot to get our heads around. To manage all that and keep it maintained, I suppose you must try and cluster your purchases so that you're not driving 100 miles between homes.
Absolutely. I mean, if you said, what's the big challenge in a business like this? The big challenge is operations. If you contrast it to an apartment complex, you've got 400 units all in one building. Now, in an individual market, you may have 1,000 properties, but obviously they're spread out geographically. We think you need a lot of scale so you can afford to have the services and the people on the ground to help service those tenants. So it's not an easy job. That's the reason why we're doing this in such big scale. And as you said, we're doing it in a number of concentrated markets, because doing this all over the country would be extremely difficult. The good news is, obviously, there was more focus in terms of where the housing downturn occurred.
Right.
And those are the markets where we're able to buy in scale and therefore operate in scale.
Well, so you're looking at, I think you said, but what, Vegas and Phoenix and Miami, where else, John?
Yeah, I was saying Phoenix and Southern California, mm-hmm. Sacramento, Chicago, Atlanta, Tampa, Miami. Vegas is a market we've just begun to look at. So it's pretty concentrated, and in all these markets, home prices fell really quite dramatically. And I would just make a comment that I think for your listeners here that housing generally is pretty compelling, that home prices have fallen quite a bit. Mortgage rates are record low. Apartment rents for regular apartments are going up quite quickly. And so everybody back in 06 wanted to buy homes when prices were quite high. Today they're nervous. Obviously, the economic environment, what's happening in Washington, is making people nervous. But as a pure value matter, I think homes are very compelling. I think for listeners, it's a good time to be an investor.
You're a smart guy. How have you thought this through when it comes to communities? Blackstone, huge, and you've got $1 billion-plus in here already. I don't know how much more is going to come, and others are pumping in big money. I mean, how do you think it'll change the complexion of a community when not just apartment buildings, that's a story we know, that's been around, but single family homes may be owned at scale by large investors, you know, remote investors. How does that change the community itself? If there are a lot more renters out there in the single family home world, I don't know, when it comes time to vote on, you know, spending on schools or all the other things that communities do close to home, John.
Yeah, I think, Tom, you have to keep in mind that there, as I said earlier, there are already 12 million homes that are rented like this.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say today we've got more than 10,000, north of $2 billion worth of homes.
Okay.
I think it's pretty small in the scheme of, you know, the overall
mm-hmm.
market. So mm-hmm. I don't think we're fundamentally changing the complexion of communities. That being said, I think it's truly a positive in the sense that if you look in these neighborhoods today and you show up and you see a vacant foreclosed home, it's generally in pretty poor condition.
Mm-hmm.
So when we show up with capital, we fix it up. That's obviously a positive for the neighborhood. And then the fact is, look, there are just people today who've got families who want to send their kids to school, but they don't have money for a down payment. I don't think the idea that somehow they shouldn't have the same opportunities and access as somebody who can afford to buy a home,
mm-hmm.
that just doesn't feel right. So I think this is a net positive. I think in the scale of the overall U.S. housing market, you know, there are 5 million homes sold in the last year. It's not huge. We're obviously tiny in the scheme of the overall
mm-hmm.
market.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what it's doing is help clear some of this inventory that's really depressing prices. And it's helped stabilize the markets. And I do think families will have professional service. You know, local individual buyers are not going to go out there and spend 10% of the purchase price on fixing up the hotels.
Mm-hmm.
The homes.
Mm-hmm.
We're going out there, we're spending 10%, we're fixing them up. And the tenants.
And you're going to trim the bushes and all the rest.
And obviously some of that's taken care of by the homeowners as well, but they're going to be, on average, and our business is just starting, but renters of single-family homes tend to be stickier than people in apartments because their kids are enrolled in school and so forth. So the data says that they stay 3-plus years. So I think this is a net positive. I think what we want to do as a country is work through this excess distressed inventory, help get these homes turned around, get people working again, and see home prices rise.
Yeah.
If that occurs, I think it'll be quite positive for the economy.
Big money always looks for an exit strategy, of course, like anybody else in its investments. Blackstone's as big as it gets. What's the exit here? Do you hang on to these homes for 3-4 years, then sell them into an improved market, or do you rent them forever?
Well, it's a great question. I'd say that's one of the uncertainties in an investment like this. You don't know when you're going in. We recognize great value here and an opportunity to deploy capital, generate favorable returns. But we are creating really a new asset class by creating a single-family for-rent national company. And so our hope is, right now our focus is deploy the capital, build the business, renovate these houses, lease them out, maintain them. And then over the fullness of time, hopefully in conjunction with a housing recovery, we'll have different exit options. One of them is obviously to take this company public. There are a couple of public companies going out there today to do this exact same business, and I think that's a real opportunity. But we really don't know the answer at this point.
Kind of mind-boggling. How far down into maintenance are you going to go? Are you going to fix the screen door? Are you going to trim the hedge?
Well, you know, it'll vary by market. Generally, homeowners will take care of most things. It'll be major appliances and roofs and some of the bigger stuff. It's a little different than being in an apartment complex, but there's a whole range of services we're going to have to provide. And that's one of the reasons why I think you got to do this in really big scale, because you need people in the markets who can travel to the individual homes and meet the tenants' needs.
John Gray, Global Head of Real Estate for the Blackstone Group, the enormous private equity outfit right in the middle of New York City. John, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about big money investors buying up lots of single-family homes across this country now, and what that means for American housing, the housing market, real estate. You want to know what it sounds like? It sounds like this. There's a foreclosure auction on the steps of the Orange County, California courthouse in September.
469.
470.
470. 471.
472.
472. 475. 475 for men going once. 475 for men going twice. 475 for men going third and final call. Taking no further.
There you go, 19 seconds, and that house is gone. Thousands are going, and you got kind of a new thing here. Not entirely. I mean, people have always owned rental properties. With us today from Philadelphia, Susan Wachter, professor of real estate and management at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Been a great guest on our show many times. Susan, welcome back. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
And Dennis McGill is with us from New York, director of research at Zelman & Associates, a research and consulting group focuses on the housing industry. Dennis, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
So we're getting that was really an interesting conversation with John Gray. I mean, this guy's huge, and Blackstone, of course, very big. Just to think of John, Susan, John Gray in the same kind of market that mom and pop buy houses in is kind of mind-blowing. If it was, you know, enormous commercial real estate, that would be more familiar to us. But this feels very new, Susan, for that big of money to be going down to, you know, your cul-de-sac.
Well, this is new. It's a new business model, but there's a new need out there in the market, and what we seem to be good at is having an entrepreneurial response, even at this large-scale entrepreneurial response. And that, too, is needed because the key issue is professional operations in terms of both making it work for the company and for the neighborhood.
Dennis McGill, take us out beyond Blackstone. I mean, they've got 10,000-plus single-family homes now. But what about other players, big money players in this space?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the most important things that John said was this isn't necessarily a new industry. It's a new industry from an institutional investor standpoint. Mm-hmm. Our numbers are a little bit higher than what John mentioned. We think there are about 14 million single-family rental homes out there. And just to put that in perspective, about a third of all rental units are single-family. and more people live in single-family rental homes than live in traditional apartment communities.
Okay.
So it's a very viable piece of the market. We are seeing the interest expand across the institutional capital world. I think if you read the headlines that are out there, as many as 4, 5, 6 different private equity funds have actively announced investing in it. Our clients that would be private equity funds that are not announced, we know have looked at it. It's a very compelling opportunity to invest in an area of the market that is, as John said, very depressed. And the most important factor, as we see it from the institutional side, is there you have billionaires and millionaires putting capital behind this initiative. And what that means to the individual, whether they own their own home, are thinking about buying a home, or are thinking about investing in a home, is that now is a good time. It's a confidence factor. The homes have been affordable for the last couple of years, but the buyer has lacked confidence. And that's just another piece of the story.
You mean if the billionaires are moving in, then what, to your eye, it looks like the market's going to come back. With that kind of capital being pumped in, that's a good signal?
I think that's what your average consumer or potential buyer thinks. And that's very different than 2 or 3 years ago when it was a greater fool theory of buying residential real estate. Now it's on the other side of that coin. As it starts going up, there's a self-fulfilling aspect to it. And the other thing that John said that's very important is there are macro implications of that. Homes are the biggest asset of the consumer. It's also the biggest liability. When you start talking about inflating home values, there's a tremendous ripple-through effect to the economy.
We've got all kinds of reaction here from our listeners. I mean, right across the board, here's a couple on Facebook. Mike writes to us, Dennis, and he says, if families aren't buying, then, you know, let them go for it. Vacant homes sap the value for homeowners in the area, so home values will increase in the area. All boats will rise. That is, if the big money comes in, Wall Street and that vein. Here's another listener, though, writes, what a deal, talking about Wall Street. Make huge money from a real estate bubble, get bailed out from the resulting crash, and then buy up the aftermath at basement prices. It's good to be Wall Street. What do you say about that range of responses, Dennis?
Well, I think the interesting comment at the end there is we were very familiar with the housing downturn and had a lot of opinions about the market being inflated and home pricing being overvalued. But if you think about it, there's fault across the spectrum. There's fault for the consumer for thinking pricing always goes up or taking a mortgage they couldn't afford. There's fault from the mortgage market for allowing it to happen. There's fault from Wall Street for securitizing it and propelling that. I think if you realize there's a lot of people that are at fault and there's a lot of people that are benefiting today, a consumer that bought a home in 2004, 2005, either at peak pricing under the right circumstances or potentially using a mortgage that they couldn't afford is actually benefiting from this phenomenon today because they're able to rent a single-family home that's very institutionalized and in some ways sophisticated as well.
That means, so by institutionalized, you mean maintained by a big company that's going to, I don't know, you know, keep the roof on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what we've really tried to emphasize for clients is as you think about housing and you take a step back from whether it's owned or rented, single-family homes and apartments, it's shelter. We're not changing the number of homes that are out there. We're not changing the need for a family of four with 2 cars and a dog to live in a single-family community. What's changed is their ability to afford it or their ability to carry the mortgage. And you have a lot of families that previously, let's say, had a $3,000 a month mortgage payment because that's where market pricing was back in 2004, 2005, that is now reset to a $1,200 a month rental payment. And the economy benefits from that reset of value. And there's a tremendous amount of loss across Wall Street from different avenues of investing in real estate and individuals
it's
losing,
really
losing money.
It's really interesting. I mean, it may work at that level of family budget very, very well, but there's also issues here of power and pride. I think I read you here, Dennis, saying something like 70% of buyers of single-family homes are now families buying to live in the homes, 30% investors buying some buying scores or even hundreds of homes.
Yeah. I think what we have to keep in mind is the institutional investor is the one that gets the notoriety today. But if you look at the last 5 years, there's been roughly 5 million, 5.5 million foreclosed homes that have sold into the market. Mm-hmm. You think, put that in perspective with the 10,000 units that John mentioned they own or other funds that own less than that. You could get as optimistic as you want as far as how much is owned by institutional investors.
Yeah.
And you're only a fraction of that transaction over that period. And that's purely REO. That's distressed. So the capital that's actually been deployed is across the spectrum. It's owner-occupiers, it's individual investors buying these homes, and it's sophisticated investors. So it is an opportunity that everybody has really had a chance at.
Let's hear from our listeners. Susan Wachter, Dennis, stand by. Victor in Buffalo, New York. Victor, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good to be back on the show.
Yeah.
I work as a property manager in the city of Buffalo in Niagara Falls. I have for about 7 years. I'm a licensed realtor.
Okay.
The company I'm working for now has over 350 units in the western New York area. And I would say at least 30% are single-family homes. And it's a desirable thing to have rentals that are single-family homes. Tenants, every day we get calls looking for just that, single-family homes. And as a business model, it works for us because it's really no different than apartments. We're able to maintain them. We're able to satisfy the tenants. We operate mainly for investors, too, and they see return on profits. Keep single-family homes rented more often than apartments. And as a whole, the business model works both for our company and for our investors. Everyone's happy.
But, Victor, isn't it a pain in the neck when you get a call from somebody, I don't know, 20 miles away and the toilet's not working right? You know, an apartment building, the super runs up and fixes it. But this sounds like a hassle, an economic problem.
You say that, and the irony is because we're in those neighborhoods all the time, we keep a crew of 10 regular employees full-time employed, and we have contractors regularly employed, I want to say maybe 25, and it works for us. We're profitable with that model, and we're able to keep going day to day. I mean, it's not uncommon for me to drive 100 miles in a day, but I'm reimbursed for doing that.
Kind of amazing. This word units applied not to apartment units, but to single-family homes. Victor, thanks for that report. Let me get one more call right here from Madison, Wisconsin. Eric's calling. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, this is really disgusting. You know, we created a false housing market and overinflated the houses. You know, we just created a complete false market. You know, we had a collapse of the banks. We bailed the banks out. Now they're buying the houses on 10 cents on the dollar, reselling them and profiting again on the taxpayers. We've made housing modifications impossible for the people to get. The HAMP mortgage modification that Barack Obama signed, there's
yep.
been virtually hardly any of them, you know, granted to people. And it's just pitiful, you know. I guess they may as well own the housing market. They control they've bought in all the agricultural land, and the big corporations control that. They may as well control and buy up all the housing and just completely dominate the country.
Eric, I hear it. No cheerleader right there for this trend. Susan Walker, help us here to look at the upside and the downside, if you see both here. How would you describe them, Susan, in this trend?
Well, I think Eric is going too far on the impact of this, and I think Dennis did point to, while this is a money-making operation so far, it appears, and of course there are going to be questions about that going down the line, and our early entrants are clearly doing better than, will have done better than later entrants as housing prices rise.
Mm-hmm.
Some, in fact, of the institutional players are leaving the market as we speak. Not to say that there still isn't great opportunity. But to put it into perspective, this is a very small portion of the housing market. And it will, even at maximum, be a small portion, less than a few percentage.
But which is a small portion? The Wall Street investment guys, or what about? I mean, there's a whole range.
Guys.
I mean, there's another range here. People who might have not 10,000 houses, but it might have 100 or 10.
Exactly. No, the 10 and 20 and 4 and 5 is a very large portion.
Well, that's kind of part of the trend too, though, isn't it? I mean,
yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. The big point here is that since 2004, there's been very little increase in the number of homeowners. There's 5 million. New renter households, and very little increase in the number of homeowners. That's 2004 to 2012. There is 5 million approximately new families that are renters, and less than a million.
Are you saying of single family homes or overall?
No, I'm speaking overall renters versus homeowners.
Yeah.
And so we are moving away from homeownership as a result of the crisis. The question in terms of the societal and policy mm-hmm. issues are, what does it mean for the neighborhood? What does it mean for the renter and for the renters, the extra 5 million
right.
households who are becoming renters? And what does it mean going forward for us as a society? These are big questions. Clearly, a home that is vacant is bad for the neighborhood.
Right.
A home that is professionally maintained is an improvement. But, you know, there are questions. What happens as rents start going up and the whole and housing prices start going up?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole basis for this concept is that rents and prices will go up.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens 3-4 years from now at that exit strategy when the current tenants must move out and their options are limited?
Let's get a call right here from Fort Knox in Kentucky. Russ, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My concern is, as the previous guest you had, is the bottom line, the dollars. I'll tell you briefly my situation. I'm in the Army. I'm due to get out really soon, a couple months.
Okay.
So obviously, my wife wants to buy a house because we've never had one because we've moved around. And I know in my area, we've got about 1,100 square foot house. We've got a small front yard, small backyard. It's a quiet neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And what we pay in rent and utilities and everything, I know I could not find an 1,100 square foot apartment for the same price that's in any kind of decent apartment community.
Yeah.
So my concern is with these big businesses moving in, buying up these houses, and they sell you on it and say, oh, we'll take care of the maintenance for free. But they're not going to just give it to you for free. You're going to have to pay for it. And then I'm going to be right back where I was, where I'm like, oh, I can pay this exorbitant amount for an apartment and have no yard, or I can pay more just so I can have a front yard. And it's kind of, it seems like, you know, I mean, maybe I'm being a little bit greedy, but renting a house to me is kind of a steal because it's a lower price rent. And I get the amenities of a nice neighborhood.
So you want to keep it under the radar, Russ, and have it work for you. No, I hear that, but I think Wall Street is on to you, maybe. Dennis, how about it? The effect of investment owners in single-family homes over, I don't know, the next few years on rental rates. And what about Russ's concern that, you know, they may throw maintenance in for now, but will they always? Will they start charging for that as an add-on?
Well, I'd make 2 points related to what we've talked about recently. One is the multifamily industry, as you think about apartments, about 10% of apartments are owned by public multifamily operators. And you can call that Wall Street. You can call it different things. It's institutional. It's very sophisticated.
Yeah.
A lot of tenants are renting from those same companies. A lot of the companies that are buying single-family homes today have that type of aspiration of basically creating a single-family REIT just like a multifamily REIT exists. The other point, from a competitive standpoint, these investors are buying at auction or buying at the MLS just like a traditional buyer would want to buy. So they have that same right to an ability to go buy at the same price. I think what the market's telling us is that there are not enough buyers, traditional buyers, to go and absorb this inventory.
Mm-hmm.
And the investors that are buying them are actually creating an upward pressure on price, which, again, benefits all the 75 million homeowners that are out there that own those homes. In general, the other thing to think about from a maintenance standpoint and whether this financially makes sense, if you think of a single-family renter, for the most part, a property manager, they would ask them to maintain the lawn, maintain any snow shoveling in areas where they have it. They do have to incur some of the cost of operating that home. An apartment company has to do all that themselves. So they're absorbing that cost. So when you think about the difficulty in servicing 100 scattered homes, there are certainly extra costs associated with that relative to an apartment community. But it also goes the other way. There are costs an apartment operator has to maintain, the amenities, the clubhouse, the pool, things that they have to pay to maintain that a single-family operator would not or a single-family investor would not because the tenant has to do that.
Square foot for square foot, does it make the house a better deal for the renter because they're putting in sweat equity with that lawn mowing, or it doesn't work that way?
Well, I think if you look nationally, the numbers that we look at, the median and average rent of a single family home is about $1,200 today. If you look across institutionalized apartment units, the rent's close to $1,000. Now, that varies dramatically by market, so you have to be careful not to take that as gospel. But there is an affordability gap, and it is pulling people out of apartments and into the single-family space. You think about multifamily rents have gone up 3, 4, 5% a year the last few years. That becomes a catalyst for people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about big money investors buying up lots of single-family homes. And we're talking sometimes very big money here, the biggest in the country, moving into thousands and thousands of single-family homes, looking at what that means for American housing, the housing market. real estate. Where do we go with this? Susan Wachter is with us, professor of real estate and management at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Dennis McGill's with us from New York, Zelman & Associates, big real estate consulting firm there. Stephanie in Boston, you're on the air, Stephanie. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to share my own experience, you know, in contrast with, you know, the discussions here about the institutional investors.
Okay.
I'm a retail investor. I have two rental properties, one single family in Newton and one condo in Harvard Square.
Okay.
And I disagree with, you know, some of the callers, the comments saying, you know, it's disgusting and so on, because I think a large part of the populations, you know, they have gone in over their head, and they probably shouldn't be, you know, owning a, you know, a property to start with because they couldn't afford it. And now when the market turns against them, which, you know, is just like, you know, that if they don't consider that as an investment, and if they cannot afford it, and, you know, to start with, they have to give it up. That's just being, you know, fair. Now, I don't think, you know, every single, you know, one of the investors, be it, you know, institutional or, you know, small investors like myself,
yep,
are, you know, have bailed out. But then if we can afford it, and if the time is right, we buy it, and, you know, we come in, you know, and we rip the gains. And I think, you know, if those people who have been complaining about that, if they are a little bit more prudent in terms of managing their own finances, they wouldn't be in the situations like they are now.
It's the market. Don't complain about it. Wise up. We hear from you, Stephanie, as the landlord there with a house in a condo. So this isn't, you know, Wall Street level, but you're definitely in there from the landlord side of the equation. I mean, Susan, what about it? I wonder if we're headed for some sort of slightly different equilibrium here in this country. Where, I mean, Stephanie says, look, a lot of people can't afford it. They shouldn't be buying homes. Does that change the sort of social equilibrium? Who owns? Who rents? Does it change the nature of neighborhoods, Susan?
Well, right now the question is there's very difficult to get credit, to get mortgages, given people's credit situation, which has deteriorated over the crisis. And also, credit constraints have ratcheted up tremendously.
Yep.
So there is a number of reasons why people are choosing to rent rather than owning, or in fact not choosing. They just can't get that mortgage. Today, of course, mortgage rates are at historic lows, and housing prices are at lows. So it's an extraordinarily affordable moment to become a homeowner.
And still it's not really, because Americans can't afford it.
And yet we have an increase in the millions of renters and less than a million of homeowners at this critical moment. So, and also for households across America as a result of the crisis, the average loss in household wealth is about $40,000.
Yeah.
So the question is, going forward, what kind of ownership society will we have? This is not to say, which, of course, is what we all want. We want everyone to have the opportunity to participate in the gains when communities revive.
It's how we've thought of ourselves as a nation.
When national wealth goes up, that this is an option for all. Now, that said, I don't want to point a finger in any way to investors in this market, whether they be small or large. The separate problem, of course, is that we were in a vicious cycle where housing prices were falling. The expectation was that housing prices would fall further, and therefore that expectation was fulfilled.
And that hurt a lot of people.
This hurt households, families across America. It hurt the banking system, and we might potentially be back there. So this is, in fact, a good move for the stabilization and recovery of housing markets. It's been critical. The investing market, the small investor and the large investor, has been critical for recovery. They've more than carried their weight in bringing that about. But we need to also look at the bigger picture in the longer run. And what happens if housing is not affordable now for families, what happens when rents continue to go up? And that certainly doesn't make housing more affordable. In fact, it is purchasing that affordable first-time home, which has been the base for family wealth building historically in America, and hopefully we can get back to that.
We've got a great range of responses here online. Karen writes to us, and she says, I'm so glad someone's doing something. My husband works for a company that transfers mid-level, high-level management frequently. It doesn't make sense for us to buy a home. I wasn't looking forward to living in a small, cramped apartment, so she's glad for more single-family homes available as rentals. Here's another listener who reminds us it's not just huge money. It says, this listener knows middle-class people who made it through the crisis unscathed and are now buying homes and condos instead of putting money in banks or other investments that, as everybody knows, are not making much of a return. But Chris looks at this, you know, private equity, giant scale, billionaires looking at it, and he writes, what would be cool is if billionaires bought up whole neighborhoods, then built castles in the middle, and instead of them paying no taxes, we just paid tribute to them directly. We're going right back to the Middle Ages with Chris's tongue-in-cheek fantasy there. Nat in Arlington, Massachusetts. Nat, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a small business owner. I'm a design builder. I do residential construction, and there's no way I can look at this model and see multiple callers and guests are saying it's affordable. But the only thing that's being proposed here is another layer of cost on the model, which is going to go to the shareholders of the private equity funds.
Yeah, but what about Susan Wachter's point? You know, we've had a market flat on its back, really in trouble. That has hurt a lot of people. So if you get some capital in here that's going to fix the homes up and get them used again, keep them from turning into, you know, abandoned shells, and yes, they may turn a profit along the way, but if they bring the market back and get people living in homes that are decently maintained, isn't that an upside?
The market was on its back because historically real estate appreciated it, I don't know, 8 to 10% year over year, and then suddenly as big investors got into residential real estate looking for returns, then that generated the bubble. But the value wasn't created there for the local communities and the homeowners. This money is just going to go out of the community. So, you know, right now I provide services to a homeowner, an addition or renovation of project. I pay my crew. That money stays right there locally in the community. There's no way a company come in, a large management company, an owner of the property, they're looking to extract return out of this.
But maybe they'll hire you to maintain a lot of these single-family homes now.
Yeah, but they can't afford to pay me what a single homeowner can pay me because they've got to get their piece off of that too.
That, interesting. Susan, where does the money go ultimately here? How do you see the flow of capital of money out of this sort of shifting relationship?
Well, the caller does have a point. Matt has a point. There is money does have to go to the shareholders, but in fact, even mom and pops do require a return on their investment. And by the way, the returns are there because housing prices are likely to continue to appreciate across America, and that's the bet. So from that perspective, the real question is who can more efficiently provide the services and to some extent, you know, this is a new play. We'll see. Maybe, and that's been the big question, can Wall Street participate in this market as at low cost as the locals? We really don't know the answer to that question.
Dennis, where do you see the housing market at this point? It's been so flat out, was flat out for such a long time. Is it coming back? Where do you think we are in that? Is it clear? What if we hit the fiscal cliff? Does that stop everything in its tracks again?
Yeah, I think fundamentally, if you think about our views on the housing market, we think we're basically in the first or second inning of a recovery. If you look back at prior recoveries, and this one was even more of a severe downturn, so you would argue it could be even steeper of a recovery. But if you ignore that, prior recoveries have been 4, 5, 6 years. And we think that we're at the early stages of that. If you look at the affordability of homes, it's still very favorable, and that's usually a key indicator when they get to the extreme side of the equation. And unaffordable, that's when you need to get worried. But today, they're very affordable. The inventory today is extraordinarily tight. If you look at the amount of homes that are listed for sale, available inventory you as a shopper could go out and look at, it's at 30-year lows when you compare that to households. Mm-hmm. And so the consumer who has been sitting on their hands through the economic downturn and has been growing their family. You've seen family formation, but people haven't been acting out of fear. I've now been thrown into a market that's all of a sudden better. Prices are going up. People are feeling more confident. And there is a self-fulfilling aspect to that. It's not just about affordability. It's matching affordability with confidence. And the market lacked confidence for the last couple of years. 2012 was the first year we got confidence back. But we feel like we're at the early stages of a recovery. And we're very optimistic that 2013 will be just as strong, if not stronger, than 12. And you can see even more momentum there. And again, there's very strong macro implications from that at both the consumer level and at the finance level.
Do you expect investment money to stay in the single family housing market when and if prices recover substantially, or and just keep renting, turn this into a new long-term business, or to flip and get out?
Well, it's always an opportunity cost for these funds or any investor and any individual you would think this way as well. It's where can you get the best return on your capital? And right now, these funds are looking at this as one of the best opportunities for their capital. That shifts through time as prices move and opportunities change. But there is a very viable opportunity to create a single family rental company that has sophistication, that has technology. As we've said, this isn't a new industry, so it's not necessarily creating an industry, it's sophisticating an industry. And you think about the technology that's lacked at trying to do this at a mom-and-pop level. If you own one or two rental homes, you can't invest in technology, you can't invest in systems, mm-hmm. you can't benefit from scale. If you have somebody that can come in and do that, and you think about all the things as a renter you would want, being able to pay your rent online, being able to request a maintenance request online, having some sophistication around that, there's a market for that. And one of the callers had a very great point. There's a lot of transition in employment. The first thing you do when you get to a new market isn't necessarily go out and buy a house. You want to understand the area. You want to understand the school districts. There's a market for transition and employment. And if you're a family and you get relocated, as she said, you don't want to get jammed up into an apartment. It's just not viable. So if there's a sophisticated rental market that you can look at, or you look at a company that might be national, you know the name in one market and you get transferred to another, there's opportunity there. So we think that there is an opportunity. Whether every company doing the investing today will evolve into that, that remains to be seen. But it's not to say that there's not an opportunity for this to evolve into a viable, sophisticated model.
Let's get a call from Asheville, North Carolina. Liam's calling. Hi, Liam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out that, you know, a lot of the conversation so far has been about, you know, the market and the health of the market. But when it comes to, a thing like housing, the market is secondary. It's a human thing, and I don't feel like there's been enough appreciation of that. It's first of all the lending bubble that was created created this huge depression in the market. That needs to be noted from the beginning. And so now there's this so-called new industry that has been created or sort of spurred on.
Yeah.
And now the same people who created it are set to profit massively, and there's a lot of degenerative effects that are going to come from that. When people do not own homes, the community is less stable, and so when people are less invested in the community, they have no incentive to make it better. They have no incentive to attend these meetings. To just be really invested in each other. It's more of a transient community, and I think that's a huge loss. And it feels really predatory. And I don't feel like that's being appreciated enough. The terms are always in the health of the market. It's not about that. It's housing. It's about quality of life for people.
Human life. Liam, I'm glad you put it just that way. I'm glad you raise it. Susan Wachter, what do you say to Liam and his concern there about the quality of community within this change?
Well, this is an interesting moment, and of course we have opportunity, and Wall Street has stepped in, and that's a good thing, because otherwise we would have vacant properties. As long as these properties are managed well and contributes to the upkeep of the neighborhood and quality of life in the neighborhood value. But there, Liam's point is quite right. What happens 3-4 years? I disagree slightly with Dennis on this. I think the exit strategy is very clear. There is a desired exit. These firms do want to sell, and when they do, the tenants will indeed need to go back to multifamily. Rents will be significantly higher then. That is what is being anticipated. I think we need to step back and think about not only what's important for the recovery of the market right now, because the recovery of the market right now is happening. That's why this is a good business model. And in fact, the recovery is likely to be greater, faster than people expect. It's likely to accelerate next
year. And the human factor that Liam raises, are you saying don't worry long-term, we'll go back to a kind of...
That's really not an option. The human factor are we will have people in homes, they will need to make choices, and they'll have a worse decision set to make choices 3 years from now than they do now, unless, and this is a big part. Part of this is that people are, in fact, they're on the sidelines themselves. They lack confidence in the fact that housing prices and rents are going to go up. The two go up together. They lack the confidence that the housing market, though, is going to come back. Rents have already come back significantly, and they're waiting. Now, while they're waiting, if they can improve their credit scores, their ability to get mortgages, and in fact make that jump back into ownership before it's not affordable for them to come back to ownership, this can be a win-win.
Well, there is a heads up on a changing profile of single-family home ownership in this country that I found very interesting, and I hope listeners... You did too. Heads up. Things are in motion here on this side of the housing collapse. Susan Wachter at the Wharton School, professor of real estate and finance there, University of Pennsylvania. Great to have you, Susan. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dennis McGill at Zelman & Associates. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity, Tom.
Thanks to John Gray at Blackstone Group Private Equity earlier in this hour. Tomorrow in this hour, we'll be listening back to the music of the great Ravi Shankar. Join us for that. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.